I would like to thank the Asia Society of Northern California for their sponsorship today, as well as the American Institute of Architects San Francisco chapter for their support of today's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, John Crickin. John Crickin is an architect who has specialized in the design of cities. For 20 years, he was a design partner with the San Francisco office of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, and is now a consulting partner with the firm. He is known for his work on large-scale commissions, designing large districts within cities, high-density inner cities, entirely new cities, and plans for the conservation and development of open land. Mr. Crickin has undertaken many major projects in Asian cities, including Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing, Tianjin, Foshan, and Ho Chi Minh, to name just a few. His work has received 26 national design awards. For the past 3 years, he's been an adjunct professor at UC Berkeley's College of Environmental Design, teaching in the Masters of Urban Design program. He's been engaged with a number of civic activities, including 17 years as chair of the Bay Conservation and Development Commission's Design Review Board. He's also been on the design review boards of the University of California, Berkeley, San Diego, and San Francisco campuses. For three mayors, he has served on the San Francisco Art Commission. He's recently completed a book on building cities for the 21st century to be published by Princeton Architectural Press and will be out by this time next year. Would you please join me in welcoming John Crickin?
Thank you, Cynthia. Maybe we could have the lights. Good. This evening, I plan to discuss some cities and lessons I've learned from those cities in Asia. In Asia, I think we all know many new compact on the land, transit-oriented cities are being created to address what would be an extreme population growth brought about mainly by the rural to urban migrations. In China, these new compact cities, I believe, have really helped them protect their scarce agricultural land and limited water supply. But to achieve these goals, the cities are very, very dense. Shanghai, for example, has a population of 18 million people. From the sky, it looks very much like a pin cushion, with each pin being a tall building. It is said that 2,000 skyscrapers were built in a single decade in Shanghai. And this is a remarkable number because I haven't specifically counted, but I don't believe there are 2,000 skyscrapers on the West Coast from Vancouver to San Diego. Anyone visiting Shanghai would, I think, quickly get a feeling for its strengths and weaknesses. But for the government, I don't believe the way this city is turning out was a lifestyle choice or was a choice of good over bad, but it really had to do with creating the single most efficient, pragmatic approach to dealing with this population. Coincidentally, it also is a sustainable approach. I think it's possible that in many world cities, there will be challenges, maybe not quite the equal to what we're seeing in China, but very serious challenges in similar ways. For us, the challenge in Asia and here at home has a lot to do with making cities denser and at the same time sustainable and livable and even desirable places to live and work. So this evening, I'm going to take you through 9 different projects that we are either now working on or have worked on, and using 6 what we would call qualities that are make livable cities to describe the particular problems. And this includes dealing with neighborhood identity, residential diversity, concentrating places of work, ease of movement, particularly on foot, green open space, balancing hardscape, and finally, working ways to make high density more acceptable and livable. The first subject then is neighborhood identity, and this is neighborhood identity in the context of what you saw of Shanghai, of really high density sprawl. In this problem, no perceivable edges to neighborhoods, no perceivable centers. In fact, a very, very weak, almost non-existent sense of place. Our first challenge with this type of problem was in Taiping Chau, a district in Shanghai. At the time, it was the largest district neighborhood plan of, it was located in the French concession area, and charming residential architecture, but very run down and lacking in utilities. So our plan was to take about 2.5 blocks of the French concession buildings and preserve them, but realign their use from residential to retail and entertainment. And then join that with a lake and park open space. The low-rise area of these two combined park and historic preservation was calculated to create a very unique identity and sense of place for this area, and that would be imparted to the surrounding high density surrounding it. The master plan vision for the preservation area was really fully realized. Narrow alleyways leading to sun-filled plazas. There is a wonderful collection of restaurants and shops. And there is a esplanade that runs through the project, lined with sidewalk cafes that I believe are occupied from 10 in the morning to 2 at night. The lake was conceived as simply a relief of open space from the surrounding density. The final lake design was conceived by Peter Walker's landscape office in Berkeley. It includes a very heavily forested park on the side that is edged with residential. And this includes 40-year-old trees planted as the beginning tree. On the opposite side of the lake is a promenade which accompanies the retail and office area. And, of course, in the foreground, you see more of the French concession restored buildings. This is a glimpse of the residential towers that frame one side of our valley, low-rise valley. And this is the retail and office side, all of which are moving forward. This low-rise center for this new neighborhood is now famous in Shanghai and, for that matter, all over China. People want to come here to recreate, they want to live here, and they want to work here. Maybe most importantly, the legacy of this project has been a nationwide interest in historic preservation, which, because of the project's success, and this truly did not exist as a priority for any city government before. The lake, which was not enthusiastically welcomed by the government, has now accepted it, and they're planning 7 more lakes in Shanghai. Maybe one other point I could raise on this. Normally, value in real estate has been measured in China on how many floors you could stack over a piece of land. So this is quite a revolution showing how the creation of identity and a very special sense of place could add a new kind of value, not through tall buildings, but through doing something special. The other example I'd like to use to talk about neighborhood identity was undertaken in the city of Foshan. Let me just tell you, the client is a Hong Kong developer, and the company is called Shuan. And the project in Foshan is the same developer as Taiping Chow. Foshan, I didn't know where it was, but it's near Guangzhou. It's in the Upper Pearl River Delta area in southern China. The site has an incredible concentration of heritage buildings, together with a 900-year-old temple here. The heritage buildings are in these darker colored lower buildings. The approach we used was very similar to Taiping Chow in that we conceived of creating a valley among the tall buildings. But here it was, I think, in my mind at least, much more healthy and interesting in that it was to be a mixed-use residential place of work. There would be some retail entertainment, but it was truly a 24-hour low-rise development, both historic and new compatible infill district. The tall buildings are at the edges appropriately where the transit corridors currently exist. Inside this valley, there are all of the historic buildings would be restored. There were some buildings built probably in the 60s and that were very incompatible and very destructive of the environment. They will be removed and replaced by more compatible design buildings. And there is a wonderful, meandering, very complex pedestrian walkway system which would be preserved. We are adding into this altogether pedestrian area a few streets to accommodate service and even public safety. And the buildings are transitioning from low to high, as you see on the right-hand side. We have planned an expanded open space around the 900-year-old temple. And importantly, I think we have limited the heights in the background so that you can always see the sort of wonderful profile of these historic roof always will be seen against the sky, not having buildings looming up behind them. Well, another fascinating problem for us is residential diversity. I don't know, I mean, I suspect that many of you are aware of this, but in China, especially northern China, there is a regulation that every single dwelling unit, not every building, but every dwelling unit, has to receive 2 hours of sunlight 365 days a year. This has set up a rigorous pattern everywhere where the buildings are running in east-west corridors, and they're spaced exactly far enough apart so that they don't throw a shadow on the next building over, which would spoil its access to sunlight. So it is, the most overwhelmingly monotonous environment that probably human beings have ever created, but it does have the sunlight. And it is not different from this, and I don't know if I mentioned already, but the buildings themselves are one unit deep because each unit has to capture that south sun, so that is another very unique quality to the residential. So the one of the what did I do? Oh, No. Ah. this project it was done for a new town in a city called Tianjin. Now, Tianjin is, if you drew sort of a east-west line to the coast from Beijing, you would. Tianjin is the coastal city. And here this is a first attempt, and here we used still an east-west orientation, as you can see. But the big difference is that we mixed the dwelling unit types so that every block that you drive by or walk by has a different presence on the street, because of the different mix of these dwelling unit types. We used also a variety of heights that is very unusual, and we used open space to capture the shadow to prevent it from being impacting, housing that would be south of that. So it was like a kit of parts that we could infinitely mix in this area, but still keeping everything in this east-west direction. And the hope for, further varied, I should say, by the landscape pathways that pass through these blocks and their landscaping. The hoped for result would be a varied and much more complex and visually engaging environment, and a very strong, hopefully strong sense of place for the neighborhood. The other example of housing repetition was for a commercial and social center for a 3 million person district within Shanghai in the northeastern portion of Shanghai. The government had proposed a 2 or 3 story shopping center, blank walls to the street, with a couple of towers coming out of it. We looked at the site and discovered that this was the one district in all of Shanghai that had 16 universities. And we thought any kind of center for this district should reflect something of the student and faculty life of this community. So where these connecting lines you see on this graphic connect or collide, it is in that location that we proposed a very new kind of social heart and a place of faculty and student housing. the big difference between what you saw before in the Tianjin project is that these were all, we got these all designated live work. So we could abandon the east-west rigor regulation, and we could begin to create courtyards and other environmental variations. Because any particular unit that did not receive the sun could be designated as work only. And so we were free of the of that constraint. On to this little village or neighborhood, we have developed a main street, which we really saw as the social heart. It is connects Fudan University to upper right-hand corner of this graphic, a technology hub, which would be a place where resources would be brought to graduate students and faculty to bring innovative ideas to market. Did I say it earlier? It's called Knowledge and Innovation City, in case I didn't mention that. The Main Street is, you might say, an idea borrowed from University Avenue in Palo Alto and Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley. It is simply an idea for a very intense sidewalk environment of cafes and bookstores and other places where people can get together. And then upstairs, above this active street, would be shops and, excuse me, not shops, but areas of work and living. Now, this is not a really fully realized, but because it's just after construction, so that the ground level is not occupied. But it is the beginnings of our main street, and you get some feeling of the diversity and variety of the architecture. This was derived by guidelines that we've created, and then the very separate, identifiably separate work of four different architectural firms. But maybe most special here compared to other housing is the ability to bring into being courtyards, some made public for gardens and possibly restaurant seating areas, and some very private, just serving the people who are living and working around them. And finally, at the other end of the street is this technology hub. And this is a sunken level that leads directly under a street and into the transit station and then across and then up to Main Street. It's a continuous straight line. This is a modern campus and was designed by our San Francisco office. The third quality of livability that we're interested in is making workplaces concentrated. And we also have another project now we're doing, not approved yet, so it's what I'm showing you is just in the works. But it's in Tianjin, and it is to be basically a central business district for a city of 14 million people. It has a fantastic site. There's this curvilinear waterway that's beautifully landscaped. It has a grouping of historic buildings that the city very much wants to keep from the French concession and the British concession. Very different architectural character, actually. And the beginnings of, and a transit connection to Beijing on the other side of this river that is only 28 minutes away by high-speed rail. And it's completely quiet, 200 miles an hour. The one of the things we found as we started the project is that there were either existing or planned little clusters of towers, all too far apart to be walkable, and maybe too close together for transit. Another pattern of that's very popular in many Chinese cities is to organize towers in long strips such as this, which creates an address for the buildings, which our clients are very interested in, but is very difficult to serve from a transit stop because the walking distances are so long. And it also does not create the kind of synergy and energy that one expects from a central business district, nor can you, bring a home-to-work transit system to kind of capitalize on the fact that you have a single destination for work. And we, in our research, we've looked at many cities worldwide to illustrate the principle of concentration of downtowns tends to be in an area, believe it, not larger than 1 kilometer, about a 15-minute walking diameter. This, I think, you recognize. So we're putting this 1 kilometer diameter, and we're beginning to work out how we could develop, a really powerful grouping or destination for work and transit. And we're trying to, this is even a drawing in progress. This is not a finished drawing, but we're trying to illustrate how this historic area can be made more vibrant and vital, and that we can develop a sort of a strategy of buffering buildings or stair-stepping buildings up before they become very tall and very dense, so as not to spoil or overwhelm this more delicate architecture. Another quality that we look at always in all projects is the ease of movement. And the particular project I want to show you here is this area is the Beijing Financial District. On the right is the World Trade International Business District. And in the middle is Tiananmen Square and the basic government facilities of Beijing. Our charge was to develop, a kind of commercial and social heart for this business district, which you can see here. This area is serviced by transit, by its second ring road, and by a super block grid of very wide streets. The wide streets are completely vulnerable to breakdown. They are very difficult for pedestrians to cross, and that the secondary streets within those blocks are mostly discontinuous. And so I would say, by the way, this is something that we all are very familiar with in suburban America as well, where we have very few wide streets instead of many smaller streets. I personally think it's an economic decision rather than anything that has to do with culture. Always try to build this more dense network of streets so that there's redundancy. If there's a breakdown, you can move to the next street exactly, you might say, like we have in San Francisco with multiple streets. This is a pretty close to the finally realized a master plan for the area. It is 6 million square feet built in a single phase. I mean, it is only numbers like that only are happening, I think, in Asia, and particularly in China. It is a mixed-use area. This is a core. It has hotel, specialty retail, entertainment, residential, cultural, performing arts area, and office and a major open space, which creates a kind of organizing identity for the area. The open space we were helped with was the San Francisco office of SWA, Landscape Architects. And there are amphitheaters, beautiful flower gardens, many different waterworks. This almost doesn't look Chinese because there's so few people, but also remember that this was close to its opening, and so it simply isn't fully occupied yet. And then it has a very changing ambience in the evening owing to some lighting effects of the surrounding buildings. And one of our hope for recommendations would be to take this green that we're developing in the center of this district and send it eastward to the Forbidden City and its open spaces, and then send it also westward to a major park you can see in the foreground of this graphic. In the very distance, you can see the International Center. The fifth has to do with green open space and the need to balance hardscape, which it always, of course, is in different ratios, but I do believe it is a universal truth that we need some balance. And I have two examples, one in Hong Kong and one in Shanghai. In Shanghai, the island and Kowloon on the mainland across, it's a city of 8 million people, which is the size of our entire Bay region. And yet this 8 million people could fit comfortably inside the city limits of San Francisco. And that's probably an order of magnitude higher density of 10 times or more. The dark area on this graphic is the central district, which is what I'm going to talk about. The central district of Hong Kong is the densest working environment of any city I know of. And of course, you know, it's all connected by bridges and walkways and escalators, and it's like a single building in many ways. And the open space one finds is often just in a traffic median a very not possible for human use except to look at. There was a time when we when the government was proposing to basically fill in this notch in the shoreline in front of the central district to add more office land use. And we took a chance and challenged this. We wanted to tell the government, we had some Hong Kong sponsors to do this, but it's filling the harbor by 1,000 feet, and we suggested that this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to create a major gathering space and open space in such a symbolically important area, because it is the shoreline of the densest part of. And here is, and our proposal is then an open space that runs that entire notch area that I showed you earlier, and opening up the harbor to 1,200 meters. The buildings that we moved that were part of the original plan, we suggested that they be relocated along the transit line connecting at the station stops, the transit line that connects the Central District to the new Hong Kong airport. The project would offer a very unusual opportunity for the public to come and walk and stroll on the waterline. It connects the conference center, seen on the lower portion of this graphic, which, by the way, our office did, and to the Star Ferry at the upper part of the image. The Star Ferry, by the way, would have to be moved forward some. The opportunities of shoreline access and views and this gathering place were very important. And it was even there was even an additional idea, which was to build a city hall and civic complex central to this arc, connected to transit, connected to water, to make it truly a super kind of civic public opportunity. And while I'm sure the design has changed somewhat from this promotional piece to change the government policy, we did succeed. The government has changed from its previous plan, and this project is being built, and which I could see from my hotel window last time I was in Hong Kong. The next project was a plan to redevelop the 10 miles of river, 20 miles of frontage of the Huangpu River in Shanghai. That is to redo the industrial and port land uses along this edge to city uses, to make it, bring it back to the city. Now, this is a huge city, 18 million people. The only natural feature in the city is this actually quite beautiful winding waterway through the city. And it's been walled off, you know, basically for all modern times. It's been out of reach of the population. So it was a wonderful, vital kind of opportunity to try to open this up for citizens. There are many, many, of course, documents that describe this, but I'm just showing here a few. On the left is a network of streets that support the uses, and if you looked very carefully, you would see a shoreline walkway a la BCDC here in the Bay Area. And on the right plan is a open space a corridor along the river, and then also perpendicular to the river leading back into the community are other open space opportunities. The area, like many Chinese cities, is well covered with subway systems. And we proposed a ferry system that connected points back and forth on both sides of the river, as well as moving up and down the river. And the last point I'd like to make on this part is that we also took, shown in yellow, major commercial streets and tried to put something special at the end of those streets to draw the people who were very active on these streets to come to the river. The arrangement of open space and building massing was designed to foster views up and down the river, and this view looking back at one of the two Shanghai suspension bridges. We also fashioned open spaces to create views to the cruise ship area, and also open spaces that would be part of these gathering places at the end of commercial streets. But then they also create interesting views and opportunities at the river's edge. The last project I'm going to show you is one of my very favorite. They're all my favorites, but this is one I've worked on for a long time, And it has to do with bringing high density or finding ways to make high density acceptable and livable. And it is in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. We won an international competition to master plan this area. The area is huge. It's 18 kilometers long. It runs the entire southern boundary of Ho Chi Minh City. And it was planned to house the next million people. Ho Chi Minh, at the time we started, was around 6 million, and now it's getting closer to 10 million people. There's a lot of inspiration you can take from existing Ho Chi Minh City. Here is a French city hall, built city hall, now the city hall of Ho Chi Minh, with the statue of Ho Chi Minh in the foreground. An incredible green city with gigantic trees, 80 to 100 feet high. They are jungle trees. And a wonderful grouping of sort of 1920s modern buildings that have a very nice climate sensibility to them. And then there are all the little side streets that are bustling with constant, continuous shops and very active life. The most unusual part of this site for openers is the incredible meandering waterways that go through it. These are not small. These are generally 100 yards in width. We had an idea, and we did the initial plan, that we would try to develop major institutional public uses that could serve the city to the north. And to the south, we would develop a kind of a green belt around a scenic river corridor. This would be our vision of the northern area with universities and parks and so forth. And this would be the scenic river corridor where we would keep the habitat, the natural vegetation and habitat along these waterway edges. But from time to time, the city would come forward and engage in these waterways. We also thought of the waterways remaining as sort of conduits for cool breeze that would come. It comes every afternoon from the south and north to the historic or existing city. And you put all this together, the roadways, the waterways, and so forth, and the land divides into very nicely proportioned and sized individual neighborhoods, walkable neighborhoods. This is the phase one area, pretty much as it stands today, although this is a little bit old. But it illustrates the engagement of water and these new neighborhoods. When we first began the project, we thought we're going to call this the City of Islands, because it was the idea of water framing all of these different places was just so powerful. The phase one is actually the most eastern part of the site. Here again is another study showing how the project breaks down into smaller neighborhoods. The green is incredible. This is a very young city, and we're already creating tree tunnels. But it's a long growing season in Vietnam. Open space has been positioned to connect pedestrian pathways through the blocks, but also manage the density of the tall buildings near the lower buildings. From a distance, looking at this grouping of buildings, it looks very different than single project large-scale developments. It has a complexity and variety that's unique, in my opinion. We made individual sites for individually architected buildings, both villas and townhouses, in the manner of San Francisco. There are many interesting perspectives and points of view and amenities. This is a absolutely sensational building that follows the curve of the river that it's viewing out to. There are wonderful narrow streets with mixed unit types. There are mixed densities along these streets. And of course, everybody has a slightly different garden. A view from the water looking back to the city. Places of cool. Now, it does get hot in Vietnam, so these are very important kite places. And then we cut, and then we have arcaded pedestrian ways in the more urban area to protect the sun from sun and rain. And these become delightful places for outdoor dining. And many of the residential areas have this continuous frontage of retail. This is studies that we're now doing to develop further the sort of the work, place of work, concentrated work. But in the foreground, you see a crescent or rounded portion of the waterway, which we have expanded, and we are now planning a crescent of buildings that look out across the water to a major park. This is being designed. I did the guidelines for it, and it's being designed by four different architectural firms, and it is intended to be the social heart of this city. Now, this was also created by a very special process. There are about probably 10 architectural firms. They're from everywhere in the world, not everywhere in the world, but they're from Malaysia, Singapore, Taiwan, China, Germany, Shanghai, Hong Kong. Anyway, many, many places. And we meet together frequently, and we plan each subsequent stage of the city's development. And it has been a wonder. It engages all the architects in the whole picture as well as their part. And, of course, it's great fun for myself and the owners of this project or the people who are developing it. Now, in conclusion, and I've run over by 7 minutes, but I hope you can appreciate that with this kind of work in Asia, where things are changing at such tremendous speed, and often with actually very limited resources behind them, you come away feeling, at least I come away feeling, that almost anything is possible. All cities can positively change, not just Asian cities, but all cities. Past mistakes can be repaired. Cities can grow denser and be more sustainable by that density, but also I believe they can be made livable and even desirable. So thank you very much for going through this with me, and I'll be happy to take any questions. Well, feng shui is everywhere. We have to take care that we deal with those kinds of questions. I think that there is a different culture in, to speak of open space. the at least at this point in time, I find that most Asian and Asian young people love to be in the city and be going into various shops versus going to relax or jog in a park or something like that. There are different ways people use time. And there are ideas that change the way you would approach it. There's a lot about you never put something at the end of a street. All of those things you must be aware of. You never shape a property with property lines that are open to the street, because that means you'll lose all your money. So you want to do it more, tight the other way. There's just a million things like that that are actually quite fun to work into your problems or your solutions, I should say. Well, I agree with you. There's some very major differences in China, and maybe a slightly lesser degree Vietnam. This varies, but acquiring land for some of these developments is a very much more simplified process than one would encounter in this country. I can take the Knowledge and Innovation City. We had one meeting. We had more than one meeting, but there was one meeting where the mayor sat at one end of the table and the heads of every single operating agency of the city went around the table, maybe 40 people. And I made a 20-minute, 30-minute presentation. It had to be brief, can't too much detail. And then everybody went around and talked, and it came back to the mayor. He made the decision, and in that three-hour time frame, it was worth maybe 3 or 4 years in San Francisco. Really, truly. So there is a big difference, but I haven't given up on the possibility of being able to be move a little faster than we move today.
I'm curious as to what the assumptions were about the automobiles per household. Are they going to be getting into a great difficulty? I mean, just to tell us a little bit about what plans for parking access and its relation to the transit system.
The parking ratios are very low. I mean, when you're on a street in Beijing or some of the Chinese cities, it seems like, my God, I've never seen so many cars. But it is the number of cars is really self-limiting, is my opinion, because these are very small cities. Imagine Hong Kong, 8 million people in a tiny area the size of San Francisco. Well, it's over 100 miles for the same number of people here. So there's just very little road space. And in Hong Kong, as maybe the most far-out example of all the Asian cities right now, the only vehicles you see on the street are service vehicles, buses, taxis, and an occasional limousine. And everybody else, you can get anywhere in Hong Kong in 15 minutes by transit, anywhere, and a little walking. So, it isn't like cars are going away, but they'll never have they could never have the car ratio of one car per person or even a half a car per person that we have here. And they're much more down to like 0.2 cars per family or per unit that they're that you're building for. This is an interesting, also maybe cultural response to parking. They would never build a parking structure that would be that would take valuable land above grade. They build parking underground, and it's just the when you're building so dense, the value of above ground land is so extremely valuable and important that it's just unconscionable to think that you're going to park on the surface. Nobody would do it.
Excellent presentation. Thank you. I'm fascinated to understand, though, why you, not you personally, but an American firm. I would think that this would be a very nationalistic, protectionist, you know, we have to have Chinese designing Chinese buildings or Chinese parks and so forth. How did you... Why do they rely on an American firm for this?
I think they see that we have, you know, that not only just Americans, but other parts of the world have had to deal with things that they're just starting to deal with, like roads and some level of vehicular use of those roads. You know, when I first interviewed for the Shuan client, we just talked about cities, what makes good cities. And there wasn't, I don't believe, a great depth of this kind of thinking in the planning institutes of the various cities. It was just coming out of the revolution. Well, it had been 10 years probably or more out of the revolution. But there was, I think there was a logical feeling that there was more depth of experience. They are bringing, because I'm teaching also at Berkeley, and there's many, many students from various Chinese cities and who work in these planning institutes, and they are, you know, building the capacity to do this eventually all themselves.
I'm thinking a little bit about the things that Jane Jacobs wrote about when she did all her kind of pioneering writing on successful cities, how cities develop, the most successful cities and neighborhoods develop organically, and sort of the fine grain of neighborhoods and mixed uses. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how do you think about those issues with the projects you presented that are so huge in scope? And also, do the things that she writes about her observations translate culturally to the Far East, or are there differences that you see?
Well, I certainly think they translate to those little streets you saw in Vietnam, and every city in Asia has this kind of fine-grained character. And the problem, and I really would put it, you know, very high ranking in the list of problems one encounters when the government is trying to build so quickly, is to find a way to break the grain down into the smallest possible feasible parts. So that when you saw Knowledge and Innovation City, we tried to break that down by different architects and then even the architects doing different designs so that it begins to have the kind of visual complexity and engagement that that is often not found where you're using repeating building types and that kind of process. I think, you know, one of the sad things, if I may say this, is that there's a lot of these cities, a lot of land area in these cities that are being built. They call it planning, but they're really architecturally designed projects that are huge in scale. They're beyond, and they're repetitious, and they gain their monumentality by their, you know, the singularity of thought, you know, the opposite of Jane Jacobs. And I find that sad. I don't know how that will, you know, work out over the long, you know, over history. But there's a lot of that stuff that's been built also in China. But anyway, that's what I work so hard to avoid, that very thing.
Just a piece of information may interest you. According to Business Week, December sales in China for the first time exceed the sales of automobile in the United States. That scares me.
Yeah. It scares me, too. The only thing, the only hope I can offer you is that at some point, should they ever get to the kind of ownership per person level that we have, no car will move. You won't even be able to back it out of your driveway. I mean, think of the thousands and thousands of miles we have just serving our of roadways. We just have our in our Bay region here for 8 million people, and then little Hong Kong, only, you know, maybe 6 miles by 7 miles. And you couldn't put enough roadway in there to provide that kind of ownership.
Do they assemble precast, pre-stressed apartment buildings, or they are not using that kind of technology? And if they do, how long can it takes and how much it costs?
I wonder if... you're asking about the technology of the buildings that we saw?
No, I am just asking generally, do they use pre-stressed, pre-cast concrete elements to assemble apartment buildings?
They do for everything that is at a certain, you know, sort of a mid-rise, up to a mid-rise height. They use concrete, and it's very fast. For buildings that are above that, you know, when you see those really super tall buildings in Shanghai and Hong Kong, they are steel. And my own experience is that these are absolutely the cutting edge of what can be built in the world at the time they're built. There's no trade-offs for, you know, being a third world or a second world country. These are buildings that maybe even have higher levels of technology than we can build in this country. Also, I just want to mention this, even though it's not a question. I didn't mention sustainability in the approach. Besides the compactness and the transit, every building that I know of and every site plan is designed to meet the LEEDs certification gold standards minimum. And many of our projects are put through that process and judged accordingly. So there is a, you know, the problem with China is burning coal. You know, that's the main problem. And if that gets solved, you know, paradise. Maybe not paradise, but...
I'm curious what the lessons learned from China can be applied here to provide more affordable housing in our cities.
There's some of the same real estate problems in Asia as there are here, in that people, at least during the bubble, were buying on spec to resell at higher levels, so that in Saigon South, the owners were always introducing buildings at a low price in the market, and then they would be purchased and then flipped almost immediately and jacked up another, you know, whatever it was, 20% or something. So that's going on, and that's not a, you know, a good lesson. And in this country, you may be familiar with this, but when we build housing for more affordable housing, the only trade-offs between the structural shell of a high rent building and a low-rent building are the finishes and the appliances. You know, the basic shell costs are the same. So that there's a, you know, but that does make a price difference, but it's not like, you know, huge in the way that would be really appropriate. I don't have any positive news there.
I just want to return briefly to the thread of car ownership and essentially the cultural transformation that China is going through and has been going through. And the question is, in creating these very compelling images that, like you say, have been kind of kind of shared and appreciated on a national scale within China, I'm curious about these visions serve a function of shifting their direction. Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, was there this last week and implored them to learn from our lessons and not adopt and go through the same problem and come to the same realization through the same long process we have, but instead learn from where we are and look for a different kind of quality of life that's not defined by the same kind of particularly automobile-driven materialism. And I'm just curious about if the projects you've worked on have kind of taken some part of the message to kind of shift that direction in their cultural direction.
Well, I would say in the spirit of designing these projects for sustainable LEEDs rating, we are thinking about pedestrians, bicycles, a very low ratio of cars to square footage, whatever the use may be.
I guess just to clarify is because there's obviously an enormous marketing campaign and a huge message that goes on with any one of these projects for them to succeed. I'm curious about the message that the developers are putting out there to the public of this is what you want, this is, you know, the future of China, or even in the case of Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh City. Is that sort of taking hold and finding some traction to kind of redirect the trajectory of their demand, contrary to their rising demand for cars? And that's the end of me.
I really don't know. I know I haven't been involved in these sort of peripheral developments where probably everything is compromised. And, and they try to make houses look like, they came from New Mexico or some other place. I mean, it's just a disgrace, and it would be wonderful for them to avoid that kind of misuse of land, and that's our constant message. But, you know, it is about the future is about cities, and that we can't let the population expansion simply destroy valuable lands. And even historical places. Okay. One last question.
I've got a few simple questions. Are you based in San Francisco? Is that where you're based from?
Yes.
And you go out to the world. How long have you been doing this, designing communities and buildings?
Well, I actually went over to... I went to. don't touch that.
That's all right. I don't want to embarrass you.
I first went to China in just after Nixon opened up China, and when everybody was still wearing Mao jackets and a very different time. And so I've been kind of involved, but only really substantially involved since maybe the late 80s.
Now, here's a question for you, because I'm very interested in architecture as an art form that is very beneficial and keeps people young. How many people in your network are over 69? Like Frank Lloyd Wright, after the age of 70, did 200 projects.
Yeah.
So how many are senior citizens who are still creating?
Well, I am a senior citizen. I am a senior citizen.
No, how many?
I have 200 more. No, it is in any given studio where we do this work, there is a, I would say that, you know, the weighting is probably 80% quite young people, I mean, with maybe 10 years of experience, and then the balance would be people with more experience.
But Asians revere age, do they not?
Oh, that's right. The, there have been times when I've been with a client, and he's asked me my age, and I know his age, and I always give him a year younger than him, because otherwise he has to be, you know, sort of revere me, and which is an awkward situation with a client. So those are little cultural sensitivities that we...
Thank you so much, John Crickin. And thank you all again for joining us, for your excellent questions. And our thanks again to the Asia Society, Northern California, and AIA San Francisco. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.